Hey, everyone. Welcome to Impossible Trade-Offs. I'm Katie Harbeth, your host. Today, we are welcoming Olga Belogova. Olga and I also worked together at Meta/Facebook way back in the day, and she is currently the director of the Emerging Technologies Initiative at the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies. She's also a lecturer at the Al Provodich Institute for Cybersecurity Studies at SAIS, where she teaches a course on disinformation and influence in the digital age. At Facebook/Meta, she led policy for countering influence operations, leading execution and development of policies on coordinated inauthentic behavior, state media capture, and hack and leaks within the trust and safety system. Prior to that, she led threat intelligence work on Russia and Eastern Europe at Facebook, identifying, tracking, and disrupting coordinated information operation campaigns, and in particular, the Internet Research Agency investigations between 2017 and 2019. Previously, Olga worked as a journalist, and her work has appeared in The Atlantic, National Review, Inside Defense, and The Globe and Mail, amongst others. She's a fellow with the Truman National Security Project and serves on their review board for Cyber WarCon. Really excited to bring you this conversation today where we're going to be talking all things about hunting trolls on the internet. Please enjoy. All right, Olga, welcome to Impossible Trade-Offs. I'm excited to have you.
Thanks for having me. I'm excited to be here.
So let's start first for people who may not be familiar with you. I did a little intro with your bio, but tell folks a little bit more about the work that you do.
Yeah. So right now, I currently work for CICE, which is part of Johns Hopkins. It's a foreign policy graduate program for those that are not familiar. And I wear a couple different hats at CICE. One of them is I teach a course within the Al Provodich Institute for Cybersecurity Studies on disinformation and influence. It's called Influence in the Digital Age. I used to teach it at Georgetown and it had a much more fun name, which was Lies, Damn Lies, and Disinformation, but I didn't get to bring that name over with me to CICE, unfortunately. So that's one of the things I do, but I also run an initiative called the Emerging Technologies Initiative, and this is a relatively new thing for CICE. I kind of wish it was there when I was a student, but it's basically meant to be a hub for basically understanding how to govern all of these new and emerging technologies that are coming out. That includes things like artificial intelligence, biotechnology, quantum computing, space technology. And the idea is really to bridge the gap that exists between the technologists and the policymakers to make sure that the technologists understand the policy and the policy people understand the technology. Not an easy feat. And again, something I wish that, you know, a lot of these schools had been doing when I was a student. But we have such a wonderful wealth of expertise to, you know, pull from at Johns Hopkins because there is the School of Medicine, School of Engineering, Applied Physics Laboratory, where there's a lot of expertise when it comes to the technology piece, and CICE brings the policy side of it. And so this is something that I'm sure you and I probably can commiserate about because of our respective prior work. But, you know, sometimes when you talk to people who are, you know, with engineering backgrounds and you're a policy person, there is a sort of gap in that conversation. You want to find a way for someone who you're working with to understand the policy challenges that you're dealing with. And that's something that, you know, you obviously talk about on your podcast as well. But that's what I'm working on now. Before coming to CICE, I worked at the company formerly known as Facebook, currently known as Meta. I still struggle with calling it Meta, but I did two different jobs there too. I worked there for about 6.5 years, started out in January of 2017 on the threat intelligence team, which at the time really worked primarily on tracking threat actors in the cybersecurity space, known as APTs, and looking for people that were either hacking the company or hacking, you know, accounts of users and trying to infiltrate different networks that the company had some control over. But that work expanded quite a bit when we started doing investigations into influence operations and trying to find troll farms. And obviously, the rest of all of that is really public history. A lot of people know about what happened there, but I had the privilege of first working on that threat intelligence team when we found, you know, the Internet Research Agency accounts and then led the Russia work specifically and Eastern Europe work on that threat intelligence team, helped build out the team that's still there today investigating this problem of influence operations around the world, helped build out the coordinated and authentic behavior policy, which I'm sure we'll talk about. And then I moved over to the policy team because that was always sort of my first love. It's what I had studied when I was in graduate school. And I made it over to the security policy team where I led the policies on countering influence operations, including a lot of different policies that we built out. And sort of the most famous of those was the coordinated embedded in authentic behavior policy.
I was doing a little bit of background research before our interview, and I came across a session you and Ben Nimmo had done at one of the Digital Atlanta Council's Digital 360s, where he called you an online troll hunter. And I just, I think it's like, that's a perfect title to kind of like, if people are wondering, what did Olga do? She was like going off and looking for a lot of those online trolls and everything.
There was a bit of a joke for a while there on the investigative team where someone created a meme where there was a picture of me with a whole bunch of trolls, like from the movie Trolls, on my shoulders. And they called me Mother of Trolls. And that became kind of my joke nickname inside the company.
You also have one of my favorite t-shirts ever. That was, what was it? Dance Like Russia Is Watching or Isn't Watching?
Isn't Watching.
Isn't Watching. Yeah.
Yeah.
That was one of, I need to get another one of those. I accidentally ripped a hole in it.
Oh, but
it
was a great shirt. Wow. You wore it that often that it was, it had been well worn. Yeah.
It had been well worn. Yeah. You know, gallows humor when we're going through all of that at the company, like you needed a little bit of it.
That was a hard time.
Now, yes, it was. Now you were mentioning how you joined the company in early 2017. You know, at least from my perspective, you know, this was sort of like a somewhat new version of a problem that people have been fighting for a while, but like there wasn't really a roadmap. There wasn't necessarily a playbook in terms of thinking about how this stuff had changed, but a lot has also changed since 2016. Can you give a little bit of history of this space and sort of how it's changed over these past, I guess, 7 years?
Well, as you said, there's the more recent history and there's the history. And in my class at SAIS, we actually go all the way back to the printing press and we talk about, you know, what different new technologies, every time they emerged, how that changed the information environment and impacted society and civic debate. So I think it really is important to have that context because when you study the history, you understand that there's a lot that we can learn from the way in which different societies have dealt with this problem in its various iterations over centuries. And in particular, you know, it's important to look back at the Cold War as well and think about Soviet active measures. There's a whole book about that by my colleague at SAIS, Thomas Ridd. But there's also a lot of work that the U.S. government did on what they called political warfare, which was the U.S. answer to Cold War active measures. And there's a lot that we can learn from the investigations and the declassified information from the U.S. government and other Western governments from the Cold War time period. The Russians have in some ways adapted their playbook, but in some ways, a lot of the things you can basically map to what they used to do during the Cold War. It's just new technologies that are being used to do those things. But fast forward to the present, much of Silicon Valley, Washington, and the rest of the world was reintroduced to this problem set in 2016, right? It existed, but you know, there wasn't as much of a focus on it. There wasn't, you know, the active measures working group and things like that. U.S. Information Agency, a lot of these things that existed during the Cold War time period weren't really existing or weren't used as much. And so people, you know, got reintroduced to this problem. And that meant that inside of companies, as I was describing, you know, there was a build out of investigative and policy teams that just simply didn't exist before. And they do exist today. I know there's been a lot of conversations around layoffs that the companies have done and what that means. But in some ways, none of this stuff even existed in 2016. And now there are teams at a lot of different companies, both small and big, that are doing this type of work, both within the trust and safety space, but also on the policy side and just across the board. There's definitely a lot of companies that still don't do it or they're too small to invest in that. But it is a field now. And specifically when it comes to disinformation and influence, it's also a field that exists within different government agencies, right? Within the U.S. government, for example, there's the Foreign Influence Task Force at the FBI. At ODNI, there's the Foreign Malign Influence Center. Cyber Command does a lot of work in this space, the Global Engagement Center at the State Department. And that's just to name a few. There's a lot of people doing this work in the U.S., but also around the world. There's hybrid centers that have sprung up, multilateral institutions that have a lot of research that they're doing into this, but also trying to come up with answers and solutions and sometimes regulations to address these problems. A lot of books have been written since 2016, for better or for worse. As someone who's very in this space, I also am very skeptical of how big it has gotten as well, because I think it's an important problem, but I worry sometimes about how we're approaching it and whether we've sort of created like a huge industry that in some ways is like a self-reinforcing mechanism.
It feels a little bit like Frankenstein's monster too, because you also have on top of all that, you have all these journalists who have this beat now. And so they're covering it. And so, you know, then you have a lot of orgs who are doing reports and trying to do this research. research, to get the press attention, which then pressures the companies. And so to your point about it being kind of self-reinforcing, everyone's like, I've got these jobs. I need to keep these jobs. You know, we need to be going out there and finding these things. And it kind of makes it keep growing and growing.
I mean, you and I both lived in Washington, D.C. for a long time, but it's also the sort of shiny object syndrome that happens here, where all of a sudden all these people that were Russia experts or counterterrorism experts are now disinformation experts, right?
And now they're AI experts.
Exactly.
Too, so let's throw AI on there.
Exactly. Now it's like it's the newest shiny object. And so, you know, I'm not trying to, you know, there's a lot of respect that I have for a lot of the people that do this work. And I think I'm really grateful that this space exists and that people are studying and paying attention to it. But I also think it's worth evaluating how we're approaching it. And if we, you know, are pouring, you know, too much salt on the wound or whatever the expression is.
Well, I do worry that like we might be also missing new things and new vector threat vectors because we're so focused on some of the old ones or like, and also having blinders on a little bit of like only talking about, now I'm going to say mis and disinformation. We're going to go into this next, but like only focusing on that. So I'll use that as a transition to do some definitions before we get into this, because we do hear a lot of people combining mis disinformation. People have added mal information in there because CISA's added that into their definition. And I know this is a pet peeve of yours and I always think about you when I see it. And so I'm hoping you can share a little bit more about why and what terms you think we should be using when talking about this space.
Yep. Yeah, you are right. This is one of my favorite subjects, Katie. So the reason it is, and it's actually, I dedicate the entire first lecture of my class to terminology and definitions because that's just how important I think it is. And it's not because I'm just pedantic and kind of mean about this, but I think we can't possibly get our responses to these problems right if we are fighting completely different things and we're talking about different things. And, you know, historically, back when sort of this field was emerging as a field, almost every conference I went to started with a let's talk about definitions conversation. That would be maybe the first hour, 2 hours of the conversation. You know, I'm glad it was, but I also think, you know, I'm not sure that we actually walked away from that with any further clarity, because you look up and read these articles nowadays and you can find the word misinformation used interchangeably with disinformation all the time. We can start by just throwing out the word fake news because, or the term fake news, because it's fundamentally useless. It doesn't really mean all that much, except this is a thing I don't like and therefore I'm going to call it fake news, right? Or you could sort of use it in a joking, sarcastic manner where it's just like, ah, you're fake news or whatever. But that doesn't really mean anything. But the reason there's an important distinction between mis and disinformation is it's the roots of the words, right? Maybe because this is, I studied Latin when I was in high school and maybe the roots of words matter to me more because of that. But when you think about someone who's misinformed, that's pretty much everybody is misinformed about something, right? Some of us don't know a lot about health or about, you know, other subjects that are not our areas of expertise, and we might just be misinformed about them. So we can share something with a family member, or they can share it with us. And it's not because they're bad people that they're telling us the wrong information or because they're maliciously trying to deceive us. It's because they just don't know any better. And that's really what misinformed means. And if we're thinking about how you address misinformation, you think about, you know, my mom sharing something with me or an uncle or whatever, you don't deal with that in the same way that you would deal with someone who's deliberately trying to deceive me, right? And that's where the distinction comes, right? It's intent, really. The term disinformation has its roots, allegedly, again, this is possibly a misinformed view, but allegedly, Joseph Stalin had coined the term disinformation, dezinformatsiya in Russian. But again, I don't know if that's actually a fact. It might just be a rumor. But ultimately, what it means is someone who is sharing false information with the intent to deceive or to harm. And I actually, what's interesting is it's a very popular term, but I tend to avoid using the term disinformation altogether because I don't think it's super helpful. When you think about what, you know, having studied Russian influence campaigns over the years, influence operations is a lot more useful because it encompasses a wider range of things that are not just content-based. Because ultimately, both mis and disinformation are content-based terms. What that means is those terms are focused on a binary. Is this piece of information, this video, this picture, is it accurate or is it false? And then the other binary is it intentionally or unintentionally shared with the intent to harm? But when you think about what, you know, Soviet active measures were during the Cold War or these broader influence campaigns, I studied and looked at what the Internet Research Agency was doing in 2016. they didn't always share false information or false stories. And so if you just focused on content, you would miss a whole bunch of stuff that they did because they were just amplifying divisive political narratives that were real and existed in the United States. There's a whole bunch of other terms that, you know, we can use and distinctions that are worth making between, for example, financially motivated operations and politically motivated ones. I know you and I talk about clickbait sometimes and sort of the important differences between what they're motivated by, which is making money, versus the people that are trying to deceive for political purposes. And then, of course, there's overt versus covert influence. Sometimes state media outlets and other things like that are involved in things like overt influence campaigns that aren't necessarily sharing false information or lying about who they are. So again, the reason the words matter is not just because I'm being, you know, a pedantic professor, but because if you try to use the same hammer to hit a whole bunch of different problems, then you're going to be messing things up, right? You don't want to punish the misinformed individual. You maybe want to share more context and information with them. And then you take down the accounts of the fake accounts and the networks that are deceiving somebody and about who they are. And that you treat these things very differently. And I actually think that if we do more of that, then we will get away from some of the politically polarizing ways in which this space has been delving into, right?
Yeah, well, and I think that you touch on a really great point, which is this work does cover a lot of different angles and surface areas. And it's not just about the content and what it says. It and people's motivations are different, like you mentioned. They could just be wanting to make money. They might actually be wanting to influence the information environment in some way. They all have different goals. And there's also different tactics that they take. And so can you walk through some of those different tactics that you have seen and sort of help people get paint a picture a little bit of what those are?
Yeah. So one, I do this a bit through the lens of the different policies that we created when I was at the team at Facebook or Meta. And one of the sort of, again, the most famous policy that our team worked on was the coordinated inauthentic behavior policy. And it was born out of us trying to wrap our arms around what was happening at a troll farm in St. Petersburg, right? How do you address this problem where there's a group of people that are working together, they're creating fake accounts. Sometimes they are sharing accurate information. Sometimes they are sharing false information, but they're pretending to be people that they are not, targeting an audience that they are not actually, you know, part of. Why are each of the letters in CIB, CIB, right? Coordinated, right? There's a lot of people that coordinate with one another. On its own, coordination is basically what most political campaigns, grassroots organizations, and other people do online, right? People talk to each other all the time. You know, they like each other's stories. You know, I work for an initiative at SAIS now. We're trying to get people to pay attention to it. And so we all make sure that someone reposts what we're sharing, right? That in and of itself, is that, you know, engaging in some kind of nefarious behavior online? No, that's basically what most people do on the internet, right? They care about causes, they amplify them. That's the coordination piece. The inauthentic piece is important because you're looking for people like what when you try to identify what the harm actually is, it's people pretending to be someone that they're not, right? And so that inauthenticity plays a big role. You combine the fact that they're working together and they're deceiving people about who they are. And then all of a sudden, it makes a little bit more sense why that policy is the way it is. And then the behavior piece is also fundamentally important because as we were just discussing, content in and of itself is not actually a determining factor for a lot of influence campaigns. Content can be misleading, right? Sometimes, you know, troll farms, Russian troll farms, other troll farms share content that was originally created by real individuals and reshare it. Does that content itself violate policies of anyone else shares it? Probably not, but it is part of a broader network that is using fake accounts, right? And so that's why the behavior piece is so important. It's about what people are doing, not necessarily what they're saying, because then you can get into dangerous territory. So that's the CIB side of it. One of the other things that we did, we started to examine the broader scope of what influence operations are and how they manifest online and all the different problems that might bring. And the automatic assumption sort of in the early days of, you know, the investigations into the space is that, oh, state media is just like that, right? Take them all down. You know, they're all fake and whatever. But ultimately, most countries around the world actually have some sort of media organization that the government supports, right? And it's also not very black and white either. There's a spectrum, right, of media control. Some governments pay more money into media organizations. Some media organizations become more independent over time. Some good examples of that are like the BBC and Voice of America that historically had more propagandistic roots, but then became less so because of laws that were put in place to protect their editorial line. And so we did an examination. We talked to a whole bunch of media capture experts, and we said, well, what is the appropriate way to treat this problem set, right? How do we actually approach it? What is media capture? And what is the fundamental problem that a user faces when they see this? Is it because they're being told lies? Not always, right? Some of the things that they report on are real stories. But it is a context problem, which is it's less about taking something down, but it's more about telling people about where they're getting their information from. And that's one of the reasons that that particular policy ultimately became a labeling and transparency policy, because we realized after talking to a whole bunch of experts in this space that what people really need is not removing this stuff from people's view, but telling them, hey, did you know that a government is associated with this? Maybe this will make you trust this source more. Maybe it won't, but that's up to you. It's giving, empowering the user to make that choice based on additional information that they now have. And last but not least, one of the other policies that we worked on within the sort of broader influence space is the hack and leak policy. Now, that's a policy that we actually never used, but it's something that was a lesson learned from 2016, where there was, you know, a hack and leak campaign, right? It wasn't necessarily that the Russian military intelligence, the GRU, only used fake accounts to amplify information that was stolen from the Hillary Clinton campaign and from the DNC, but it was also that news organizations shared those stories too, right? I can't tell you how many people published like the four juiciest stories from the Podesta leaks, right? And the way a hack and leak campaign works is that usually, and in this case, Russian military intelligence hacked the campaign and the DNC, and then they took that information and they wanted to make it public. Some of it, you know, there's some information that shows that they might have manipulated some of the information and made some changes to it. But some of it was harmful in and of itself because it's non-public information, kind of like the Snowden leaks and WikiLeaks and other things that was now being made public. And you don't necessarily have to alter or taint those leaks in order to, for them to be harmful to public debate. But what's interesting is the distinction between what happened in the United States and then what happened in 2017 in France when the Macron campaign got hacked. And because of the media blackout in France, what ended up happening is the stories that were written by media organizations in France were the second day stories, which is who hacked the Macron campaign and what were they trying to achieve? It wasn't, here are the four juiciest stories from the Podesta leaks, right? And the media environment actually made a really big difference in that story. And so when we built a hack and leak policy, we were really thinking about how do we make sure that we give people context as well about where this information is coming from if something like 2016 happens again? It wasn't a policy that we ended up using, but we wanted to be prepared for that outcome.
And I think another important area too is the Macedonian teenagers that were also running a lot of things during 2016. And these operations still consist today, just trying to get people to click on links to go where there's an ad farm or selling t-shirts and merchandise. Like there's also trying to influence journalists, like you said, to write these types of things or to be, you know, making people think that they're doing this stuff. So it's actually a much wider and broader world than just purely is what the content is, fake or not, and is it coming from a state actor or not. And I also think that gets more complicated too. Like we talk a lot of like Russia, China, Iran, but if Canada or Mexico are trying to influence debate in the United States around, let's say, the border policy or something like that, is that nefarious? Is that allowed or not allowed, right? Like, it gets complicated when you start getting into the borderline stuff.
Or if people inside of a particular country are engaging in these types of campaigns targeting their own domestic population, right? That's one of the reasons why it's important that these policies be agnostic of, you know, it can't just be about foreign interference, because interfering in public debate and creating fake accounts should be problematic no matter where you're coming from. And that's why it's interesting when we talk about terminology. I can understand why the European Union and other places use terms like FIMI. FIMI has the word foreign in front of it, and the Foreign Influence Task Force and all of these organizations have the word foreign in front of what they are defining, in part because they want to step away from any sort of accusations of censorship in domestic civic debate. But when you are an investigator and you're looking for a campaign like this, you can look for foreign interference and you will find domestic actors that are doing the exact same thing.
Or they're working together potentially, or like, so it's really hard to separate, or you may not even know when you first find it if it's foreign or domestic. And so you can't necessarily, it's not like it comes, I always joked like when we had the election war room and like reporters that I'm like, I feel like you all want like some sort of red siren that would go off of like Russians found. And I'm like, that's not exactly how this works.
Yeah, I remember those days.
So I wanted to ask, because you were leading into this here at the end. I don't want you to give any information away that helps the, you know, folks who are trying to evade detection, give them any clues on how to do that. But to the extent that you can you explain a bit more about how threat intelligence teams do the research to try to find these networks?
Yep. And I also think one of the things that I want to make clear at the outset is you don't always have to have specialized internal knowledge and data in order to be able to do this kind of work. A lot of what we did, and you and I did together as well, is work with research organizations like the Digital Forensic Research Lab and others who actually identified and found lots of these networks without having some sort of prioritized internal data. And stepping outside of that, you know, this is the way I always explain it to students and to new investigators and other people. You have to actually just go down to the basics, which is, okay, what do I know about this place? Let's go back. There's a troll farm in St. Petersburg. So it's in Russia in a particular time zone. And they are engaging, allegedly, we believe that they might be engaging in some kind of interference and they might be creating some accounts. So what do we know about the people that work there, right? There's actually, from 2013 through 2015, there was a ton of information about what was happening at this troll farm in St. Petersburg in Russian independent media and from whistleblowers that had come forward from the troll farm. So we knew a lot about the fact that people are working in shifts. They have certain requirements and quotas for how many times they might post a day. They might have instructions for different topics that they might want to cover. And so one of the things that you might want to do is you place yourself in the mindset of the bad guy and you think, okay, well, if I were to interfere in this election or I wanted to engage in some sort of manipulation of civic debate in a particular area, not around an election, but any other time period, what are some of the divisive issues that exist there? How would I take advantage of them? If you do all of the exercise and you put yourself in the mindset of that person and you start to think, okay, well, they probably need to have a phone number in order to register a fake account, because that's how some platforms work. You need to have a phone number and an email address. Okay, so that means that they might be acquiring SIM cards or email addresses en masse, right? That's very, you know, again, none of this is secret information. It's just logic, right? Okay, so maybe they're sitting in a building together and they're working the same hours. So that's kind of interesting. So can I narrow my investigative search by looking at when people are posting? And they've gotten better at this. Some of them, you know, try to adapt their posting times and all of that. But things like that, that give you a sense of what is someone's day-to-day job like and how would they run an operation? There's this idea that our former colleague Ben Nimmo and Eric Hutchins and other people have put out these ideas of kill chains that exist in the cybersecurity space, which is you have to think about the sort of order of operations of someone running an operation. And then you think about the places at which point you can actually make it harder for them to do those things, right? Maybe it's a product gap that they're taking advantage of. Maybe it's, you know, they need to buy fake IDs, right? One of the indicted entities and also sanctioned entities by the U.S. Treasury Department was a Pakistani fake ID company called Second Eye Solutions that was sanctioned because they were providing fake IDs for people creating Russian fake accounts, right? So you think about all of the different things that someone might need to do to create a troll farm, and then you start to pick apart, like, where can you actually find that using your investigative skills? And so that's how you would go about doing it, right? Okay, you know something about their hours of work. You narrow your search by that. At the time, you know, things like buying ads with rubles, right? Very obvious and easy, but, you know, you can narrow your search that way. And, you know, all of a sudden you're going from like hundreds of thousands of accounts and ads, and you've narrowed down your search even more to the techniques that you know you've seen these threat actors engage in before, or that you might know based on reading open source intelligence from independent journalists in that country.
Yeah. And I think that's where, to your point of what you were saying, the collaboration, not only between the companies themselves, but with the government and with open source researchers, numbers because, you know, they, some have common data, some have different sets of data. And so by combining it together, you might, because a lot of this stuff is happening cross-platform too. It's not like they're like, we're only on Facebook, we're only on Twitter. They're exploiting the loopholes in all the different platforms that are happening.
Exactly.
And also, this is kind of a space too, I think, what you were saying, there's no finish line. Like, I keep having to remind folks that, like, we're never, there's never going to be a mission accomplished banner. And it's like, we've solved all the problems of the internet. Like,
because that's always worked out so well before.
I know, right? Exactly. And, you know, like you were saying, you close different loopholes, you make it more harder for them to do one tactic. They might switch to another tactic, switch to another platform. And so, how have you seen the tactics? There has been some evolution since 2017, but also, what are some of the same things that they're doing? Because I hear a lot, you and I've been in some of these rooms where people are like, oh my God, did you hear about how the Russians are now making copycat websites of like news organizations? And we're both like, yeah, they've been doing that for a while, like fully aware of that. It is not new of what is happening. And so can you share a little bit about like what's different and what is the same?
Yeah, I mean, what's the same is the fact that, you know, there's all these new technologies, right? But that doesn't mean that someone's going to go and use all of them, right? Most of the threat actors will use the lowest hanging fruit, whatever's easiest and cheapest for them to do, right? If, you know, I've watched a couple of videos of people who used to work at the troll farm in St. Petersburg, and they basically go to the sort of Russian Facebook mirror site, Vkontakte, and they take a couple pictures of someone else's profile, they upload it into Facebook, they come up with a fake name of a person and a sort of persona. They don't need a generative AI image from this person does not exist. .com to create that fake account, because they can just steal a picture from someone else. It's probably faster to do it and easier, because then you can have multiple photos of the same person and looks more legitimate. And so there's a lot of things that people are going to keep doing because like they can get away with it. And so they will keep doing those things. As you said, those copycat websites, it's not just the Russians that have been doing that, but you know, there's a network that we took down. You might remember this one from Iran back in, I think 2017 time period, or maybe 2018. And they did spoof domains a lot, right? They spoofed a French website, news website, Politico, they called it politicito.com. And like, they did a whole bunch of things that again, others have done since then. And that's the other interesting thing, you know, you were saying, you know, people like discover this space anew, and then they like, are like, oh my God, did you know that they geofence websites, or they, you know, doppelganger creates, you know, the same website and all that. Like, first of all, Doppelganger was an investigation, Russia network that was identified almost 2 years ago at this point. But there's still news stories being written about it that are kind of like, this is a new thing where, I mean, they are certainly a very prolific network from what I've heard from investigators that work on this stuff. But that doesn't mean that a lot of what they're doing is necessarily new. But that said, threat actors adapt to what they know companies are looking for, right? My old team would publish these threat reports, and a lot of different companies would, and they would talk about the different techniques like we are that we know threat actors engage in. They probably listen to your podcast. They probably listen to other conversations, and they're going to say, okay, well, now that they know we're doing this, can we get away with doing that still, or should we change, right? Some easy things, right? I mentioned the rubles, right? They're not going to buy ads with rubles anymore, right? They're going to maybe adapt to have more sophisticated operational security, trying to, you know, find a way to use a VPN that they didn't use before, so they're not all sitting on the same IP address. Little things like that, where maybe they learn some lessons from the way they got caught before, and so they're going to change what they do. Some of them, again, especially like new and emerging threat actors, are just going to do what they can until they realize that their account is getting taken down, and then they maybe change tactics. So I actually don't think like that there's too much new under the sun. You know, I definitely recommend continuing to read some of these threat reports where the investigative teams are constantly trying to identify what the new tactics are. But for the most part, I think you see a lot of the same, except with some exceptions where, you know, they've learned that they might not get away with it anymore.
Now, are there certain, I mean, we talk a lot about Russia, China, Iran. I don't know if you would say that they're the ones that do most of sort of interference in other places around the globe. But I'm kind of curious, like, what countries are most well known for doing this type of stuff? And then are there certain countries that are more targeted than others that they tend to focus on?
Yeah, so I think this is actually a kind of a hard question to answer, because there's always, to put it in the worst possible way, some unknown unknowns.
And I use that term all the time. Thanks, Donald Rumsfeld.
Exactly. And also, what I would say is availability bias. So let's say you're putting together an investigative threat intelligence team, and you say, okay, guys, we have an election coming up, and please go find all the Russian troll farms. So what do you know? They're going to come back to you and find a whole bunch of things that are Russia related. And that's not to say that Russia is necessarily doing more than everybody else is, but it's you're finding it because you're looking for it more, right? And so that is actually an important thing to caveat, because sometimes you'll see, especially in the coverage of some of this field, people be like, the Chinese are doing more than they've ever done before. It's like, are they? Or are there just more people looking for it, right? Have they all been doing it all along and we just didn't know about it or catch it because there weren't as many investigative teams focused on this? And so I think that that's an important caveat to add to the conversation. That said, you know, as someone who is perhaps biased because I originally am from Ukraine and I've also studied Russian influence campaigns perhaps more than others, I do think, you know, if you look at the best in the business of influence operations, the Russians have been doing this for a long time. You can study the history, as I said, of Soviet active measures. There's a cultural sort of knowledge set here of being able to be good at understanding human beings, what makes them tick, and then also being able to manipulate the information environment to your advantage. So I do think, you know, they are the best at what they do, but there are other countries that have been doing this for a really long time too. They maybe just aren't as good at it. I also think there's also different types of ways to engage in influence, right? There is online networks and fake accounts, but some of this, you know, practice, as we said, has proceeded and has a long history before social media platforms existed. And so one interesting thing I talk about with my students is Chinese influence campaigns. A lot of them are more focused on diplomatic efforts or paying influencers to travel to Xinjiang in China and talk about the amazing food there, or people that are, you know, being paid off for Confucius Institutes, or finding ways to utilize Hollywood to make, you know, the Chinese space station, the one that saves Sandra Bullock in the movie Gravity, right? Little things like that, that are a different means of influence and portraying yourself to the world that are not the sort of traditional ways that we talk about. And so there are a lot of, you know, interesting countries that have done this for years. I also think an important thing is, as I mentioned before, if you look at some of the Meta reports and other companies' reports, you'll see this trend line upwards of domestic influence campaigns, where countries and governments and political parties are targeting their own domestic populations. And we saw a big uptick. There was a report when we put out a couple years ago that was sort of the big threat report on influence operations. And I think the number three prolific actor was Mexico or country. That's because there was a lot of political parties and dark PR firms in Mexico that were targeting domestic audiences. So that's how you end up with some of the most targeted and some of the most prolific actors in this space, is because of what they do in the domestic space. And to answer your other question about who might be targeted more than others, I have this debate with my students sometimes about whether, you know, is it authoritarian countries or democratic countries that are more vulnerable to influence campaigns? And it's an open debate, but you can say that, you know, open societies create a lot of space for conversation, but that means that they're also in some ways vulnerable to someone inserting themselves into those conversations. I'm still a big proponent, you know, as a citizen of the United States and, you know, a big fan of democracy, I think that we need to preserve, you know, our freedom of expression and not sort of crack down on civic debate, because otherwise we're sort of playing into the hands of the threat actors. But there are places, you know, one of the reasons we talk about the Philippines and Myanmar and other places where, you know, domestic authoritarian governments have targeted their populations, it's because, you know, there's been a history of government-controlled media, a lack of digital literacy, and people using digital tools very prolifically, right? I think the Philippines for a really long time was one of the places where people used Facebook as the internet for more than most other countries in the world. And I think digital literacy plays a really big role in whether a particular population might be vulnerable and what their history is with media and independent media as well.
Well, and I think another thing too that's important for us to mention is that the folks doing this work are not all necessarily state actors. Like Clint Watts the other week, you know, was talking about how this stuff is getting a lot more like domestic, which we've talked about, but also commercialized. There's a lot of agencies that you can hire in different countries that I remember us taking down and finding where they're basically for hire to run websites, to be pushing out either pro content about their client or anti-client content about their opponent. And that starts to even get even trickier when you are, again, kind of in a more more democratic society and sort of freedom of speech and like what's legitimate campaigning versus not, and how much transparency and disclosure is required before it becomes okay. Like, I remember one of the debates us having of being like, if the Russians just say they're Russia and doing it, does that make it okay? Like, you know,
or another interesting
transparency.
Yeah. Another interesting debate is also, you know, I don't know if you remember this or you were still, I think you were still at the company. I can't remember. When Mayor Bloomberg was actually, you know, paying influencers, right?
Oh, the influencers. Oh my God. Yes. I do remember that.
But, you know, let's put it in terms that make sense to everybody, which is most like makeup companies, a whole bunch of other commercial entities pay somebody to advertise their products, right? So where is the line, right? Are we going to say that, you know, this CoverGirl commercial is fake because the woman from America's Next Top Model never actually uses that face cream that she says is great, right? Is that disinformation? Like, let's discuss whether those things are all problematic. And maybe they are. Maybe like we have some fundamental problems in our society around like truth and how we sell information and sell products. But ultimately, at some point, and I also talk about this with my class, politicians became products too, right? And you can watch Mad Men when they're talking about the Kennedy versus Nixon debates and which product was more appealing to the general public. Or you could go back to, you know, or even talk about Maggie Thatcher, right? She was one of the first political candidates in the UK that had a PR firm that changed her image entirely to appeal to a particular audience. And so, you know, I think there's a lot of open questions around like, what is acceptable and what do we as a society want to normalize within sort of political conversation? Is it only if the Chinese are paying influencers or can everyone pay influencers? Like, what is acceptable, right?
So I want to go into another common rant that we both have, which is around artificial intelligence. I swear every time I open Threads or anywhere I get my news, there is a headline talking about how it is the end of days. AI has destroyed our information ecosystem. It is running rampant and we should all just unplug and go curl up in a ball in the corner, which is not true. So you've talked a bit about like how AI may or may not being used in these campaigns, but can you talk about too how we talk about these things and the narratives can also impact how people are thinking about and their trust in the information environment?
Yeah, no, I worry about this all the time. This is my current soapbox that I'm constantly on. And I know you and I have had that conversation too, right? And actually, you know, I have some headlines that I pulled maybe a month or two ago where, you know, I'm going to read a couple of them. The big election year, how AI is undermining the vote in 2024. Open season for AI to impact the election. Elections and disinformation are colliding like never before in 2024. And those are just a few of them. There's all these different analogies related to all kinds of apocalyptic events, floods, waves, epidemics, all kinds of things where like the world is coming to an end. And the reason I'm frustrated by it is not because I just want everyone to calm down. I want everyone to calm down in a way because I also have studied Russian influence campaigns for the majority of my career. And I know that one of the things I say all the time is that Russian influence operations dating back to Cold War active measures to today are not always trying to get you to believe anything in particular. They're trying to get you to believe nothing at all and trust nothing at all. And when I think about sort of the fundamental societal issues that we're grappling with in the United States, but also a lot of the world is dealing with, is rebuilding trust in institutions. These are the things that make it hard for us to, you know, we have very polarized political environment. And if we blame all of the things on some external force, then we don't focus on the real domestic issues that we have. And instead, people walk away thinking that they can't trust anything. They can't trust the outcome of the election. They can't trust their election bodies. They can't trust their politicians because everything is fake. And I think that that helps the Russians and other threat actors win, because ultimately, the most important thing that we need to protect is that trust. The trust between society and its political and media institutions and others. And I worry because I think about those, you know, Macedonian troll farms, and I worry sometimes about how different it is our headlines are from the ones that they're pushing out to try to make money, right? Everyone's got their own incentive structures, but you know, I sometimes show, you know, clips of various newscasts to my students. And, you know, because this has become such an industry, right? Which, you know, to be fair, like, I think like I have probably benefited from it as well, right? I have a job as a professor. I've worked on the subject. I sort of have job security because people continue to care about this problem. I acknowledge that. But I also would rather not have a job than have our society completely torn apart and believe that they can't trust anything at all. Because then we become like some of the other countries that are already sort of further down that rabbit hole, where people just are so jaded. You know, I'm an immigrant to the United States. And I think one of the beautiful things about this place is that, you know, like civic debate is about participation, like people being involved in it. And they're going to participate only if they believe in it. And I know that's really cheesy, yeah, but I really believe that.
No, I think so. And I think that too, that, you know, back to what we were talking about earlier about how some of this might be sort of self-reinforcing, because like I too have a job because of this and have been able to do consulting and all of that. And like, and again, I acknowledge that as well, but also this is where my panic responsibly line kind of comes from, because we need to make sure that we're looking at this and really thinking about our own contributions, whether you're a journalist, a headline writer, an editor, like, you know, a person at a tech company, organization. Like there's, we have to think about those things a bit more rather than just like the immediate gratification of getting a press story out there or getting more attention for the things that we're doing. So last question for you. It's obviously a big year of elections. What are the things that you're kind of keeping an eye on as we really kind of start into the really big elections that are happening?
So I hate to sort of be repetitive here, but this is what I think about when it comes to all the elections around the world. And I'll bring an example from 2020 in the United States, where there was an Iranian network that didn't really have much of a presence on social media. But one of the things that they did was email a whole bunch of people pretending to be the Proud Boys and say that they are the Proud Boys and trying to intimidate people and tell them not to vote or tell them to vote for Donald Trump or else, right? And so there's this interesting thing here, because it's the Iranian threat actors are pretending to be the Proud Boys, and they are basically trying to undermine voting. And in addition to that, one of the things that they do is they send out a video that tries to prove, I think it was set to Metallica music. And the video was allegedly trying to prove that they have hacked into a voting database and they are interfering with the vote, right? When I think about that problem, that's what my old team used to call perception hacking, which is it's not actually about like running some sort of successful campaign to get someone to do something or not do something. But it actually is about getting people to think, oh my God, did these people hack into the voting systems? And now we don't really know what the truth is, right? And you think about what happened in the United States, but also in Brazil, right? Where ultimately the problem wasn't the outcome of the election, but it was what happened afterward and people's trust in the peaceful transfer of power. So I think about that a lot, because I think unfortunately people saw what happened in the United States and Brazil and they're like, oh, what a useful model. let's pick that up and play with it, whether it's the threat actors in the information environment or sort of general, you know, people who want to push for political unrest. It's not even directly tied to the problem that I work on, but I feel very grateful that there are a lot of civil society groups, researchers inside and outside of companies and governments that are still doing this work. And I think we can't measure the successful outcome of elections just by whether a particular political candidate wins or doesn't win. That's not how you measure whether it's successful. You measure whether it's successful is if people continue to trust the institutions that are responsible for those elections and, you know, if there's a peaceful transfer of power afterward.
Well, we'll leave it there. I agree 100%. Olga, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you so much for joining me on this episode of Impossible Trade-Offs. You can find the show notes and everything for this podcast on my Substack at anchorchange.substack.com. I want to thank my guests for doing this, and this episode was edited by Claude Jennings Jr. I hope you all have a great day, and thank you so much.